We talk a lot on this podcast about chess improvement, but when it comes to improving your hiring processes, Indeed is the platform you need. Indeed has over 350 million global monthly visitors, and it has a matching engine that helps you find quality work candidates fast. You can use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with your candidates faster. And Indeed doesn't just help you hire faster. 93% of employers agree that Indeed delivers the highest quality matches compared to other job sites, according to a recent Indeed survey. Years ago, when I was running a chess teaching business, I found it hard to find good help, and I had to go through a lot of back and forth to even screen potential candidates. Indeed allows you to do those things efficiently in one place. Indeed's matching engine is constantly learning from your preferences, so the more you use Indeed for hiring, the better it gets. Join more than 3.5 million businesses worldwide that use Indeed to hire great talent fast. And listeners of Perpetual Chess will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility if you go to Indeed.com/chess. Just go to Indeed.com/chess right now, and you'll be supporting our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast, Indeed.com/chess. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
Hello, it is Ryan, and I was on a flight the other day playing one of my favorite social spin slot games on ChumbaCasino.com. I looked over at the person sitting next to me, and you know what they were doing? They were also playing Chumba Casino. Coincidence? I think not. Everybody's loving having fun with it. Chumba Casino is home to hundreds of casino-style games that you can play for free anytime, anywhere, even at 30,000 feet. So sign up now at ChumbaCasino.com to claim your free welcome bonus. That's ChumbaCasino.com and live the Chumba life.
No purchase necessary. VGW. Void where prohibited by law. See terms and conditions. 18 plus.
Judy was boring.
Hello.
Then Judy discovered ChumbaCasino.com.
It's my little escape.
Now Judy's the life of the party.
Oh, baby, mama's bringing home the bacon.
Whoa, take it easy, Judy. The Chumba life is for everybody. So go to ChumbaCasino.com and play over 100 casino-style games. Join today and play for free for your chance to redeem some serious prizes. ChumbaCasino.com. No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
Hey, everyone. Before we get to today's episode of Perpetual Chess, I just wanted to say thanks to everyone who has supported the show. Ways to support Perpetual Chess include telling a friend about the show, subscribing on Apple Podcasts or whatever platform you use. Better yet, leaving a positive review on that platform. But most of all, I want to thank the people who've supported me with the new Patreon page. If you haven't heard, it's patreon.com/perpetualchess. And the suggested donation there is $2 a month. So I tried to keep it as affordable as possible for as many people as possible. The donations go to cover things like the production, the audio equipment, and the hosting for the show. So if you can't afford it, you definitely shouldn't donate. But if you can, it's really appreciated and it helps out a lot. And guess what? I think it's also going to make the show better. What we're going to do is people who donate to the show will get advance notice of the guests and they will have the chance to send in questions to the guests. So if you feel like there's some topic I don't cover enough, or if you have some favorite player that you're waiting for them to come on, well, there's a good chance we're going to get them at some point. So now you can sit back and wait. And then when someone's coming on who interests you, you can pounce like a cheetah and get your questions in. I think this is going to make it a better show overall, more community driven. I've always said I want this show to be by the people and for the people. Well, I think that this will help make that happen. So thanks again for all the support and enjoy today's episode. Hello, everyone. I'm Ben Johnson, and this is the Perpetual Chess Podcast. On Perpetual Chess, I have weekly conversations with the chess world's best players, promoters, and educators about their lives, careers, current projects, and best practices. For more information, go to perpetualchesspod.com. Hey, everyone. Welcome to Perpetual Chess. We've got another great guest today who I will get to in a second. But first, I just wanted to quickly mention that there will not be an episode next week. Here in the United States, we have a holiday coming up, Thanksgiving, and I will be traveling. I will be in the car for 4 days with two children under 5 years old. So say a little prayer for me. I would rather be podcasting and I'll be back at it next week, but that's just a heads up. But the good news is for this week, we've got a great guest, supporter of the podcast, outstanding chess player, women's grandmaster, Tatyav Abrahamian. Tatyav, thanks for joining us.
Oh, thanks for having me.
So Tatyev, I know that you've listened to at least a few shows. So you may be keen to the fact that when someone's recently played in a tournament, we like to start out by talking about it. And unlike some recent guests, your last tournament looks like it was a pretty good showing to me. So how was your tournament in Los Angeles?
Well, it was a very small tournament, only 5 rounds over 2 days. I played way too many children that I wanted to play. It was a pretty good tournament. I can't say I was happy about the quality of my games, but I'm rarely happy about the quality of my games. But it's always nice to score some points. And I had a long break. I didn't play during the summer. And then I had a tournament in September, and my next one is going to be over Thanksgiving, so I just wanted to get a small tournament in.
Oh, okay. So what's coming up over Thanksgiving?
Well, there's a tournament in Orange County. Well, it's in SoCal. It used to be in LA, now it's in Orange County. It's going to be the American Open.
Oh, fun. Yeah, that's a big one, right?
Yeah, it hasn't been for the past few years, but this year there are a lot of players coming from the universities from Texas, so there'll be 7 grandmasters. So I'm hoping I'll get to play at least 3 or 4 of them.
Okay. And I know that you like a lot of us, are someone who plays and also does some coaching. So how on top of your game are you able to stay during the course of the year?
Oh, that's a good question. I feel like I haven't been playing as much lately, especially this year, because I spent so much time in St. Louis working there. But, I mean, when I'm playing, I feel like I just give my all when, you know, I'm trying very hard at the board and not trying my best in every game. But, yeah, the problem is between the tournaments. So that part is, I feel, it's a little bit challenging, especially when you have a lot of lessons, or, like, I also teach after school, so sometimes, you know, things really pile up, or when one of our coaches is not here, so I have to start covering for them. So, I mean, I'm not, I think my time management is quite poor, so I'm not on top of my game as much as I should be.
Time management in chess or in life or in both?
In both.
Yeah, I think they might, I wonder if they go together. Like, I wonder if people who, you know, like time trouble addicts are also, like, often late for stuff.
Probably. Because, you know, it's like you have to feel this urgency to do something. Like in chess, you have to have this pressure to move, and in life, like you have to have a deadline to actually get things done. At least that's true for me. I don't, maybe it's different for other people. Maybe they, different things motivate them.
Yeah, me too. I'm a procrastinator by nature. So like definitely like back when I was in college, like writing papers and stuff like that, I would put off to the last minute. But I found that as a chess teacher, it's just not a good job for procrastinating. Like you just can't be late, you know. So it's actually broken me in my habits a little bit, because if you're the only, if the kids are all counting on you to be there, it's like the one thing you can't really mess around with.
Yeah, but the problem is when you're at school and you know you have a paper to write, you can just pull an all-nighter, write your paper, turn it in, and then you're done. Or you study and then you get a test, and the test is on what you studied, and unfortunately you cannot do that in chess.
Right. Well, do you try to like cram your opening lines when you have a tournament coming up?
Sometimes. Yeah, I have a tournament coming up and I have to start looking over my lines.
And do you, I mean, you played, sorry, go ahead.
I said you're making me feel bad about my preparation.
Sorry, that was not my goal. I mean, I think everyone knows that, like, you know, unless you're top 20 in the world or whatever, you have to pay the bills. So it's no small feat to strike a balance between like actually making a living, whether it's in chess or outside of chess, and then competing, you know, and the stronger you are, the harder it is, like the less room for error you have. So I think people will understand and feel like you're doing just fine.
Yeah, I mean, it's also hard because, you know, like, you have a weakness in chess. Let's say your endgames are bad, and then you dedicate, like, months studying endgames, and then you go to the next tournament and you don't get a single endgame.
Right,
and
exactly.
It kind of feels like you wasted all your time, you know?
Yeah. And do you feel like you have, is that speaking from personal experience, or do you feel like you have a different weakness, or? Or no weaknesses?
All the weaknesses.
Right.
I mean, that has happened to me before, that I was trying to work on my, like, a certain opening in a positional chess, and then that happened to me, and I felt like I made the wrong decision, and I was, like, really upset after the game, felt like a waste, but I don't think it's, I want to say it's never a waste, really, because, you know, you're improving, and it's like just because you learn something or you're doing it well while you're practicing doesn't mean you're going to be able to do it during the tournament. Like, sometimes before a tournament, like, I'll solve puzzles, and I feel like I'm so sharp, and then during the games, I keep blundering. I don't know. It just feels like those two things are disconnected, even though I know they're not.
Yeah, I think it makes a difference in the long run, but in the short run, it's kind of tough to see the connection.
Mm-hmm.
So you work for the American Chess Academy, is that?
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so... and so you said you do after-school programs. You also do some private lessons. And we've seen your work in St. Louis. So it seems like you keep pretty busy.
Yeah, so we have I work with the American Chess Academy. We have locations in Southern California, in the Valley, in Glendale and Burbank, Pasadena. So we actually have a physical location. So I teach there. I do some after school. So I do private lessons. I don't think I work like 24/7. I'm constantly teaching. So the job in St. Louis actually helps me a lot because, you know, it just, like, this year I took the whole summer off and I was there, and, you know, I could make like a decent amount of money that lasts me throughout the year. So it's kind of a nice to have a balance and have different incomes, I think. So you're not fully committed to one thing. So if something goes wrong, you know, you don't have a backup.
Yeah. I feel that way too. Like, that part of the reason my motivation for starting this podcast was like just to have a different outlet. I mean, I love teaching and it's fun, but like, yeah, you definitely sort of, if there's never a break, you it's hard to maintain your motivation to be good at it.
Yeah, it's very easy to get burned out from teaching, and it has happened to me before because, you know, it's self-employment, but then it becomes a routine. And that's one of the fun parts of, you know, playing chess and teaching, is you have a flexible schedule and you get to travel and this and that. But when you don't have tournaments coming up and you're just at home and, you know, like every day becomes the same, then I think it becomes a little overwhelming.
Yeah, for sure. And you, so this academy, you work with your former coach, mm-hmm. Armin Arbat. Sorry, can you say his name? Sorry, can you say it again?
It's Armin Arbatumian.
Okay, I apologize, Armin. It sounds like it's a pretty successful program if there are that many locations.
Yeah, I mean, Southern California is, and LA even is so spread out, so it's very, you know, very easy to have different locations. But we have, in Glendale only, we have 150 kids.
Okay.
Of all different levels, which I think for a chess school is really big.
So how is it structured? They come to classes at night, or you guys do tournaments, or all of the above, or what?
Yeah, all of the above. We do 4 tournaments a year. One of the tournaments is actually with Kasparov Chess Foundation, so they sponsor the tournament. There's actually prizes.
That's great.
Yeah, and we have weekly classes. We have twice a week, we have more advanced group, twice a week, more beginners, the tournament player, but still beginner, and we have also complete beginner group, so, you know, for all levels. So we actually have a location rented, and we have the chess set up and everything. So they just come, they, you know, they play, and then at the end we do a lecture, and we give them homework, and that's our structure.
Okay, and do you guys, you mentioned renting a place for tournaments, but do you have, like, a physical location for the academy generally?
Yeah, that's what I mean. We have a location for an academy.
Okay, that's what I thought the first time, but then I wasn't sure the second time you mentioned it. So I just wanted to be clear because, you know, it's a lot of this is just my own personal interest because I know some chess teachers that are pretty successful with like brick and mortar academies, but it's always seems like higher risk, higher reward sort of business model than just, you know, working from your house or going to people's houses and schools and stuff like that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, like I said, it's good to do like different things, I think.
Yeah.
I mean, I know a lot of people aren't able to, but if you're able to, it's a good thing to do.
Yeah. And I imagine you have a good relationship since Armin was your coach for so many years and now you guys work together.
Oh, yeah. Armin, I think, is like one of the best people ever.
Nice.
He's been so nice to me since I moved here. And, you know, he's so understanding when I take time off. I'll tell him, no, I'm going to St. Louis. It's, you know, he's... Like, he never tells me, oh, you can't go or anything. Like, he's also a World Youth Coach, so like those are the times that I have to be in town, or if he has something to do, I have to be in town.
Right.
But I just take so much time off, you know. It's like I'm such a terrible employee because you know, I play U.S. Championship, I play internationally, I'm in St. Louis all the time.
No, I mean, but come on, Tatya, if it's good for the brand to have like a chess star like yourself working for the company. But
no, but I mean, it's like it's so nice because I know someone's going to be covering for me, and you know, he's just so understanding of what I do. And
yeah, no, it is good.
And I just have a relationship like that.
Yeah, and it's not always a given that, like, within an organization, especially like sort of like small chess teaching sort of organization, that there's going to even be the coverage. You know, that you would have someone to do it. Okay, so since we've already mentioned Armenia a little bit, we might as well get into your background. So you came to the U.S. when you were 13. I'm a sucker for the, like, come to the U.S. stories. And I find, of course, being that I host this podcast, I find the chess stories, like the interconnection of chess, particularly interesting. So you were, like, a young talent and came here. How was that experience, like, both on both sides of it, like, leaving Armenia and coming to a totally different place?
Oh, it's pretty terrible. I don't think, well, my experience is different because a lot of chess players come here as students, so I feel like there's more of a conscious choice to do that and, you know, make a choice to stay in the United States. And I was very young, so it was my family's choice to do that. Actually, my family applied to come to the U.S. in 1991, and they had a visa, but things didn't work out, so they weren't able to come. And then in 2001, at some point, they got a letter saying, you know, we have 3 more months until your visa expires. And then your visa expires and you can't come here anymore. So at that time, our situation, financial situation in Armenia was really bad because, you know, after the collapse of the Soviet Union, my mom lost her job. My dad was making like $20 per month.
Wow.
Yeah. And, you know, there are like electricity outages, so we'll have electricity a few hours a day. We wouldn't have, like, never had like running hot water. And like, we lived in the center of the city, so we still had like water, and you know, like, life was still better than not living in the center of the city. But financially, my family was really struggling. So my parents decided, you know, they're gonna sell the apartment. They sold the apartment at the cost of the tickets to come to the US. And actually, my dad couldn't come for the first few months. I don't remember why not. There was some issue, I think, with his paperwork or something like that. So I came with my mom and my sister, and then my dad joined us. And I mean, it was a very difficult transition for me because it just came out of nowhere. My parents told me we're moving to the U.S. Like, I didn't want to leave. I had my life there. I had my chess. And I think that's a very difficult age because, you know, you're a teenager, you already have a sense of yourself, but not really. And, you know, you have a life already, you have your friends and everything. So it was very difficult for me when we moved here.
Yeah, understandably. So there's a lot that I want to follow up on from that. But so first of all, I'm reading up a little bit. It looked like, so were your parents like academics, or what was their background?
Yeah, both my parents were chemists in Armenia. So my dad was working at a university. I believe he was doing the research department. But my mom stopped working. Like, I don't remember her. Actually, yeah, I can't even remember her working because I feel like she lost her job pretty soon after.
Yeah, I just wanted to highlight that because, you know, people listening might not realize. I mean, hopefully realize, but like, it's not like your parents weren't qualified to have work. Like, they're, you know, obviously if they're chemists, they're very smart people, worked very hard in their field. So to be struggling that much to get by, I mean, and to have kids, I mean, it's got to be, you know, scary situation. So you know, obviously it's hard on the kid, but probably a good thing that you guys made the move for the long term.
Yeah, I mean, I like, at the time, of course, like, I knew my family was struggling, but, you know, it's like you still don't have a full grasp on it, or, and change is scary, especially a change like that. Yeah, so, I mean, right now I realize that was the best thing to do, but at the time I was very resentful that I had to do it.
Yeah, of course.
And yeah, my parents, they're both very well educated. My dad was also a jeweler, besides being a chemist, and I think that was his passion because That was, or maybe that's how he could make money, but that's why he was spending a lot of time on it. But, you know, they're both talented and smart people. So, of course, they're qualified to have a job. But when you have a revolution like that, all kinds of things can happen in your country.
Yeah, for sure. And so speaking of your country, obviously, it's got rich chess history. And I read that you were a product of the Armenian chess house. So could you tell us a little bit about, I mean, I know that you were like a young talent and representing both Armenia and then later the U.S., but what was the chess education like there?
Yeah, it's a very different culture. Because when parents, I feel like in Armenia, when parents take their kids to chess, it's the goal is for their kids to become a chess player. It's not just, you know, I want my kid to have something to do. I want my kid to do well at school. I mean, maybe it's different now because they do have chess in schools now. So, like, everyone is learning how to play chess. So I feel like now they're using chess as a different tool. But I think if you're taking your kid to chess school, you want them to become a chess player. So my chess lessons consisted of 3 times a week of 2-3 hours each lesson, which is, I think, is completely unheard of in the U.S. for, like, sure. A chess school. But in Armenia, that's normal. Like, that's just what you do.
Wow. That's amazing. I mean, that explains why you're so strong, for one thing. I mean, obviously, along with, like, the work that you put in and probably some talent. But so what would be the nature of those lessons? Like, what would you do for those, like, 9 hours a week?
Oh, my God. I never put it that way. That's 9 hours a week of lessons. I just thought, like, 2 times a week for 2-3 hours. Okay, let me try to remember. I think we'd start the lessons with playing someone, and then my coach in Armenia was absolutely amazing. He's like the nicest person ever. His rate was $20 per month, and my parents couldn't afford it, so he taught me for free for 5 years.
Wow.
Yeah. And he was a big believer in the Dvoretsky book, so that is what we're working on. And at the time, of course, there's no computers, no access or anything. So he would make copies of the, what is that book that has all the novelties in it? The Informant.
Oh, right. Yeah.
So that was a big thing, right? Because that's the only way you have access to games. And yeah. He didn't even have books. He would just copy the book. So that's another thing we would do. And also, before playing in a tournament, because we had the Armenian Youth Championship, so that's the tournament you have to win to qualify for World Youth. So we would copy the games of our opponents in the notebook, so we knew what our opponents play, because, you know, it was a few high-rated kids that at the end you're going to have to play. So you basically, instead of, like, looking them up on Chessbase, you're, like, copying their games in your notebook and copying the games from the informant, your openings in the notebook. So I think I still have those, my notebooks with the homework he would give me. And, like, even the homework, it wasn't a copy of paper. He would, like, tell us the position, and you write down the position, and then you have to write a solution. So I still have those notebooks with all the games and all the puzzles that I was given as a kid.
That's funny. And you were, so you started when you were 8, and you were kind of identified as a talent right away. Is that, like, how does that happen? Like, do you just have a coach who says you're good, or is there, like, I guess you probably have a rating system just like we do, as I think about it.
No, actually our system there is very different. So you don't, you play in, oh my God, the words are escaping me. You play in this category tournament.
Like qualifiers. Okay.
I think it's a Soviet system. So you get, like, when you're a beginner, you play in 4th category, 3rd, 2nd, and 1st, and then you have to score, I believe, 7 points out of 9, and once you become 1st category, you get your first rating of 2,000. So before I moved to the U.S., I've never heard of a rating below 2,000, because you cannot go below 2,000.
So that's
when I came here, and I said, this rating... No, it's like an Armenian rating.
Oh, okay, it's not even a FIDE rating. Okay.
No. Because they're not FIDE rated tournament.
Gotcha.
So you're, again, like, I don't know how, I feel like it's still is the same system, but when I first came to the US and I see this rating, like, 1600, 1500, I was like, shocked. I was like, 1600, they probably don't know how to play chess. What's a 1600 rating? Like, how can you be below 2000? But I think in Armenia, when you go to chess school, you have to know how to play chess. I don't think they, like, any of the coaches will be sitting here and kind of, you know, teaching you, babysitting you. And, like, if you make a like, it's unacceptable if you go and, like, you're messing up the pieces and you don't know how they move. I don't think anyone would accept you.
Okay. So you learn somewhere else and then you go there to get better.
Yeah, I learned from my dad. It was very accidental, I think, how I learned how to play chess.
How do you mean?
Well, I was at my dad took me to his work and he was cleaning his office and then he had a chess set. So I asked him, like, what is this? And then he told me, oh, it's a game. So I asked him to teach me and then he said, oh, I'll just play with my friends and then you can watch me and then you can learn. So that's how I learned how to play.
Oh, so it's like the legend of, I can't remember which grandmaster that, like, was it Capablanca who supposedly learned just by watching his dad?
Well, I don't think it's just, like, out of nowhere. Like, I think he's, like, taught me how the pieces move.
Okay.
And then, like, I learned more about the game by just watching his friends. Like, he thought that's a good way to learn.
Okay.
That's how I started playing.
And, Tatyev, I follow you on Twitter, and, you know, I enjoy your tweets across the spectrum, but but we'll leave it at that for now. But one thing I've noticed is you've got great pride in Armenia. You know, when there's tweets about the Armenian genocide, you know, obviously extremely tragic event in global history, you often highlight that. And when Armenian chess players are doing well in tournaments, obviously most prominently Levaronian, but others as well, you're always cheering them on. So what do you think, why do you think you have such a strong sense of place with your home country?
I think that's how I was raised. I think that's how everyone in Armenia is. Like, everyone has a big pride about their country, which has its good things and bad things, of course, as all things do.
Right,
you
of
know,
course.
It's good to be proud of your culture and your heritage, but you don't want to be so blinded. You don't see the bad sides. And I think that was one of the challenges when I moved here because, like, I had this strong identity of an Armenian. And then I moved to the U.S. and then, you know, it's like a new culture. Everything is different and it's kind of like, where do I fit in? Like, where do my beliefs fit in? And that was a really long journey and, like, an internal struggle for me.
Yeah, I mean, moving, like you said, moving at the age of 13 is hard. You know, as a teacher, I've noticed that I, like, you know, when I teach young students, like, say, below age 10, girls are just nicer than boys, you know? They're just more respectful and more supportive of each other. But then sometime around the early teens, it kind of flips for a while. Girls can be mean to each other at that age. And, you know, California, sort of the California high schools from all the TV shows sort of have this reputation of being, like, very cliquish. So I don't know how your English was when you came in, but it must have just been immense culture shock, like, to start to be changing everything like that at that age.
Yeah. Well, when we first moved in, we were living with, at first, well, like, we didn't have any money. So we were living with my dad's best friend's family, who's been here for, like, forever, like 20, 30 years, something like that. And then we moved in with another family who were friends with my parents. They were actually, when my friends were applying to come to the US, it was them and I think two other families. They got to know each other. They knew each other, and the other families moved, but my parents didn't. So we're staying with them, and we're staying in Burbank, which is, I think, more American. It's, like, less immigrant. So I was going to the school, and, like, I didn't speak English, and it was just terrible. I think 9/11 was one of my first days of school, and wow, Everyone was watching TV, and, like, I had no idea what was going on. I was amazed that there's a television in an American school.
Right.
Like, that was the part that, like, really amazed me. But then we moved to Glendale, and Glendale is very immigrant populated, especially Armenian. So I started going to a school that had an ESL program, so it was easier, so I could make friends and actually talk to people, and my English started to improve. When I moved here, I didn't speak English.
Wow, I can't imagine what that must have been like. Well, I mean, obviously, you've done fine for yourself. Since then, did your parents, were they able to find jobs, like, eventually?
Yeah, well, at first we were on welfare. My mom went actor school, actually. She became a nurse, which I think is amazing because she also didn't speak English. But, you know, she managed and now she has a good job. My dad was also doing some jewelry jobs because his best friend was a jeweler. So he was, he found some kind of a job.
Nice. And you mentioned you have a sister. Is she older or younger?
Just older.
Okay. Does she play chess at all?
She knows how to, but I think my parents actually taught her how to play chess first, but she didn't really get into it.
Okay. So. Okay. And so, like, what was your rating when you came here? Like, so age 13, 2001, like, how good were you compared to the other kids of your age?
I think I was 23-something.
Oh, wow. Okay.
I think I was overrated.
That's rare. You might be the first person on Perpetual Chess to admit to being overrated at any point. Not that everyone comes in and says they were underrated, but you just don't hear that admission very often.
Yeah, because you know, I don't know how the system was or is now, but like when you first play, the way your rating increases is more drastic, right?
Right.
Before you play 5 games.
Oh, so you're saying you're USCF, like, yeah.
Yeah, not my FIDE.
Yeah, that makes sense. Okay. So small sample, yeah. Okay, but still,
I maintained that rating somehow, but I don't know if it represented my strength. I was number one for my age on the years I wasn't in the same category as Hikaru.
Okay.
So most years I was number one in my age.
Okay, and that's boys and girls alike, right?
Mm-hmm.
So I imagine pretty quickly you started getting invited to, like, you know, junior open and stuff, like the junior closed rather, and stuff like that.
So I didn't play in my US championship until I was 16. I'm not sure if I was qualifying by rating, but there was a rule back then that when you switch federations, you have to wait 3 years. And since I represented Armenia in World Youth, that applied to me. I don't want to say like I was qualified. That's the reason I didn't play. Like, I don't even know if I could qualify by rating. But I played my first U.S. championship, I want to say 2004. And that year was something weird was going on because they had 2 U.S. championships. I think actually that's the year that Jennifer won the Invitational.
Okay.
Oh my god, this is so long ago. Like, I can't imagine. Like, I can't believe how long 2004. How long ago was 2004? Yeah. But I think they had a special tournament because they needed a qualifier for the Olympiad. And then, if you remember back then, US Championship was men and women played together, and which of course doesn't make sense for the purpose of determining a champion. Like, it was 64 players, and like whoever scored the best from women was the US Women's Champion. So they had like 2 US Championship that year. I want to say it was 2004.
Okay. And and there's probably the U.S. Women's Olympiad. So when did you make your debut there?
Oh, actually, when I first moved here, my first big tournament was the Nationals. So I won the Nationals twice for 8th and 9th grade.
Let me be the last person to congratulate you for that.
Oh, thank you.
You're welcome.
First Olympiad was 2008, actually.
Okay. Yeah, so this was your first Olympiad for the U.S., but in my intrepid research, I read that you went to the 96 Olympiad, or you watched Judah Polgar in the 96 Olympiad?
Yeah, I mean, I didn't play that, actually, obviously, but yeah, that's the year that the Olympiad was held in Armenia.
Okay.
Now that I think about it, I think it's just amazing that the Olympiad was awarded to Armenia during those years.
Well, I mean, you know, FIDE will go anywhere. That much is well established.
Yeah, because, like, sometimes, like, I asked, like, a few players, and the way they described it, it sounded a little sketchy.
Okay, like,
you know, like the way you find a hotel, or it's like the food and the condition. But I mean, understandably so, because 1996 Armenia was like not in a good place. But I mean, it was just amazing watching the Olympiad and, you know, being in that room and all the players. My dad would take me every day, so we would go to watch the games.
That must have been pretty inspiring.
Yeah, it really was. I mean, it's just like Olympiad is the best tournament to be in. I mean, playing in Olympiad is just amazing. Even watching it is amazing. You know, all these great players in one room. And like when you're playing, you can just walk through the hall and then you see like Aronian, Magnus, and like all these great players in one room, and you're just playing in the same room. It's just mind blowing.
Yeah, I always feel that way on like the Chess 24 broadcast, like when they go to break. Like, you know, I obviously the coverage is great too, but when they go to break and they're just showing the room, it's always like, you know, randomly like Magnus walks out in front of the camera, and like then there he is talking to Aronian or whoever, and it's like you get more of a sense of like what it's like to be there, you know, which, you know, for me, like that's basically as close as I'll get. So yeah, it's fun to watch.
Yeah, it's amazing. Like in the dining hall or in like in the elevator, you run into someone, or in the bus, like just like Magnus walks in or someone just walks in.
Right.
Like I remember one, I think last Olympiad, like I was walking behind this guy, and he's just like, the way he's walking, he's like stumbling around, his like shirt is tucked out, and I was like, who is this person? Then at some point he turned around and it was Magnus. I was like, oh my God, it was Magnus walking in front of me.
That's funny. So you said that Judah Polgar was your hero. I mean, obviously there's lots of reasons she could be your hero, but like, what was it about her that made you look up to her?
Well, she was the only woman playing among men, and I thought that was really inspiring. And, you know, because in my group, with my coach, I think I was the only girl, and there was another girl. And I was the strongest, or one of the strongest. And like when you're playing in the Armenian Championship, there's a girl section and a boy section. And I think I wasn't worse than any of the guys, but I was playing in the girl section and I was, you know, winning and playing in World Youth. But, you know, like I always had this competitive urge, like I wanted to beat all the boys and like play among them. And it was really inspiring to see her do it.
Yeah, amazing. And I, from what I've gathered from your chess.com videos, it seems like you maybe have a similar style. Are you an attacking player?
Yeah, I'm a very aggressive player.
Nice. Yeah, so she's a good hero. Have you read her books?
No, actually I haven't. And I didn't even listen to her podcast on your show.
Okay. Well, I'll forgive you.
It's really bad because when I saw it, I was so excited, and then I never listened to it.
Okay. I mean, as a fan of hers, I don't feel like we covered all that much new ground, but yeah, she's, you know, she's got some good stories in there. But one thing I will say is like her books are really good. I hadn't read them either until she was coming on the podcast, and then I had like a week to read all three of them. But I mean, it's kind of a unique blend of like, you know, memoir and game review, and she kind of mixes them in, and her enthusiasm for chess sort of really shines through in the books. And the other thing that shines through is sort of her appreciation of like the moments, you know, of like how unique it was to be like at the Olympiad and be this like amazing young talent with Kasparov like going out of his way to check out your games and stuff like that. Like, she's got amazing memory of like lots of details and like good appreciation for like how much, you know, how incredible a life she's led. So, and it's good for teaching too, because like, since she goes from when she's like, you know, a young girl, it's like not everything is like so advanced that, you know, kids can't learn from it. And the stories are good. The stories she tells leading up to the games are good hooks for the kids. So anyway, strong recommendation for all three of those books.
Yeah, I mean, definitely. I mean, it's just amazing just by her existence. I think she has inspired so many people, so many women. You know, she didn't even have, like, she doesn't even have to say anything, right? You just hear, like, especially before she quit, of course. Like, you go to a tournament and you see Judith Polgar and you're like, oh my God, it's Judith Polgar.
Yeah. Yeah. And her games are like, they're so much fun. I mean, like,
yeah,
like she could have had that rating without being like such a fun player to study, you know, but she happens to just have an amazing like style that everyone can learn from. Okay, well, since I mentioned the topic of books, Tatyov, as you probably know, I'm always looking for book recommendations for our listeners. So do you have any books that were particularly, other than the Dvoretsky books that you mentioned, that were like really formative for you?
Yeah, I mean, I definitely grew up on the Dvoretsky books. Oh my God, and I have to admit that I don't read chess books.
I'm sure it's true of a lot of our guests, but sunshine is the best disinfectant, so it's good that you admit it.
No, I actually like Auger's books a lot. Yeah. I think they're really good. I feel like he kind of follows, I think Auger is like this generation or today's Dvoretsky.
Yeah, I agree. And he said that he learned so much from him, so I think it's not a coincidence.
And I guess when it comes to like teaching, Dvoretsky is probably the one who paved the way for, or at least set kind of the like the system of how to teach or how the approach to follow. And yeah, I mean, Auger's books are just great. I have all the series I've done. He's attacking, the Grandmaster series, what is Attack and Defense, I think?
That's the one. I'm sorry, I'm drawing a blank too.
So I've done that one. I've done his positional books. I'm working through that. I try to vary it up. Like, I don't, you know, I don't want to just, you know, you take one book and you just work one thing. So I try to sometimes do end game, sometimes do like positional chess. So I'm going through at least halfway through his strategic play, and I'm also working on his end game book.
Okay.
I really recommend his books. His books are really good.
Yeah, it's definitely been a theme. So, I still haven't gotten a chance to check most of them out, but definitely like when I get the time to sink my teeth into some chess study, I'll be going straight for those books. So besides books, like if you do get a chance to study chess, like what do you do? Like, I mean, okay, for example, obviously you have the U.S. Women's Championship, I'm sure your biggest tournament of the year, months away. So how much of your time is spent, like, preparing for your friends and opponents? And how much of it is just, like, generically trying to improve your chess?
I try not to, like, I'm not going to start studying for the U.S. Women's right now, because I feel like if I put so much emphasis on one tournament and make it like the highlight of my year, is just too much pressure on me.
So and have you learned that from experience? Like, did you used to do that, or are you just sort of, you kind of knew all along as a seasoned chess player?
I think just the U.S. Championship just has so much baggage for me because of my history.
Right.
And my results, so I think just in and of itself, the tournament is just like I already cannot just play it like any other tournament. Like,
right.
There's just too much baggage and too much history, and you know, if especially I feel like last year after every game, it wasn't just like, oh, I lost the game, or I won a game. It's like, oh, I won a game, now this is gonna happen. Oh, this person is doing like this, and last year they did like this, the other year they did like that, so. You know, all these things, like all these scenarios after every game that I had in my mind. And then, like, what happened at the end, you know, was, you know, because, like, when I looked at the, went back and looked at the tournament, like, after I think first half of the tournament after five rounds, Sabina was at 50%. So, she wasn't the favorite. Like, you have 50% after five rounds, you're not the favorite to win when other people have, like, 4 out of 5 or 3.5 out of 5. And then I realized, oh, you know, this, like, it's a long tournament and, you have to pace yourself and you cannot have all this baggage, which of course is very easy to say in theory, but in practice it's very hard to do.
Yeah, for sure.
But and I'm going to have a lot of tournaments. I'm playing a tournament this weekend. I'm going to play in Reykjavik Open.
Oh, fun.
I'm hoping to get at least 2 more tournaments before that. So I cannot just ignore those tournaments and focus on US Championship.
Yeah. So,
but as far as the US...
Oh, no, I was just going to say, so it sounds like it's more like the, in terms of my question, it's more the latter. You just want to get better at chess and the rest will take care of itself.
Well, in general, I do, but of course for US Championship, I do specific preparation because I've played in the US Championship so many times and I've played a lot of the players so many times. And it's actually very funny because I feel like every US Championship is like the same, like I get the same colors against everyone. Like, I played against Sabina probably, like, 8 times or 9 times, and I played against her with white at least 6 times.
Huh.
It's like, and then, you know, against Nazi, I played, like, white every time. There are, like, several players, like, I get the same colors against them, like, every tournament. So I feel like my U.S. Championship is not just repetitive in terms of the players, but instead of the, in terms of the colors I get against them.
That's
so funny. It's...
Okay.
So, it's funny.
I want to get back to the U.S. Championship, but this can't. You're saying that makes me think of the Hu Yifan controversy. I can't help but open that can of worms. What do you think of the like her being paired against a woman like over and over and over again? You think it was random or no?
I really didn't understand that because her whole issue was she thought that the organizers were conspiring against her, right?
Right, presumably.
And I wasn't sure why she would feel it would be that way because this is not a FIDE tournament, you know. It's not like I can't even think of a FIDE tournament where she would play and where both men and women play together. Okay, it's not like let's say the Rapid and Blitz tournament or something like that where everyone can play. And, you know, it's like an open turn. It's at least not an open tournament, but it's like organized by one person, and I thought she would have good relationship with the organizer, so it was very surprising that she would think that someone's conspiring against her.
Yeah, well, the thing is, I think at first she might have felt that way too, but at some point, like, it's so statistically improbable. Like, you know, the first time you think, oh, that's a coincidence, and then the second time you think, okay, you know, it happens. And the third time, you're like, this is getting weird. And then by the fourth time, you're like, what the hell is going on? How does this keep happening? And then it carried over into her next tournament. So I certainly don't think she handled it the best way, but I could see how, like, that, you know, you could start with, like, benign explanations and then let your mind go elsewhere for how it keeps happening.
Yeah, I think I'm sure it was frustrating for her because, for a long time, like, I saw her play in this tournament, the Grand Prix and even the Women's World Championship. Well, Women's World Championship, I can understand. It's, like, one tournament per year. But the Grand Prix, like, takes up, like, how many tournaments is it? Like, 4 or 5 tournaments? You know, there's, like, half of your yearly schedule. So I was, like, for the past few years, I always wondered, like, why is she playing in this? You know, it's like, you're so much stronger. You keep beating these people. Like, what purpose is it serving you?
Well, it's a, like, pretty good paycheck, for one thing.
Yeah, but, she lives in China, and doesn't the government, like, take most of your money anyways? Or, I thought maybe the Federation maybe is making her own thing, but even from their point of view, I would think they would want her, you know, to grow as a player. Like, how many times can you win the same tournament?
Yeah, no, it's a good point about the government. I forgot about that. Yeah, well, and now it seems like she's sort of moving in that direction, right? Like, she's mostly trying to compete in men's events.
They're open events. They're not men's events.
That, yeah, thank you. Yeah, no, that's
no, I think it's going to be good for her as a chess player because it's really interesting because when I look at this top women and the tournaments they play in, their schedule is very similar to this top chess players like Magnus and Levon. Like, they play in very select tournaments because, you know, they don't have that many tournaments to pick from. But when I look at the top women, they're like 2,500, 2,600, and, well, very few are 2,600. Actually, wait, no one is 2,600 besides Hu Yifan, right?
I think a couple are close, but I think it's just her.
I don't think Juven Jun is 26. Yeah, I don't. Yeah, so most of them are mid to high 2,500, the very top ones. And there are so many tournaments for them to play in, but they only play in the select tournaments. And, like, I probably it's financial, but I just always wonder why not broader new horizons. Actually, yeah. 1 year I was playing in, not 1 year, 2 years ago, I was playing for US team in the world team, and Anna and Crush declined, so I was playing board one. So I was playing all these top women, like Kostyniuk and Muzychuk, and so I was preparing, and at some point I realized, like, I'm seeing the same games over and over, and I'm like, why is this happening? And then I realized it's because they're constantly playing against each other, so when I'm preparing, I'm just looking at the same games over and over and over.
Oh, right, from, like, different sides.
Yeah, so, like, because I'm looking at a game, and I'm like, I've seen this game, and the next round, I'm like, I've seen this game, this looks so familiar, like, where is this from? Then I'm like, oh, they're just playing against each other. And, like, for me, I play in the US Championship every year, and, like, I get that experience, like, I'm playing the same players, but it's one tournament, and I play... On a good year, I play like 10 tournaments.
Right.
And anyway, like, I'm not trying to criticize them. I'm just, you know, I'm just, like, it's just something I've noticed. And, like, I wonder if it's just financial or it just probably makes more sense.
Yeah. Well, hopefully we'll have Kostyniuk or someone like that on someday and can try to get to the bottom of it.
Yeah, I actually admire her a lot. Like, she's a very fierce competitor. If you ever seen her play, like, she's like a true professional. She approaches, like, if you see her play, her intensity here, like, you can feel like she's a competitor. I'm sure, you know, she's more, I don't want to say out there, but she's like more open. She's done more interviews and things like that. So when you read about her, like her preparation, I think before she played Hu Yifan in the World Championship match like years ago, she said she went somewhere away from civilization to prepare for that match alone. So she's a very, like, a strong competitor.
Yeah. Yeah, very, very focused whenever they, like, pan to her on the on the camera.
Okay. Yeah, even if she's giving a sign ball or anything, she's just her intensity, and, like, I admire her. I admire that a lot.
Yeah. Okay, so getting back to the U.S. Championship, I mean, I feel like this is a topic that's come up a few times because the chess world can seem so small, but I imagine a lot of these players are friends of yours that you're playing every year. So is it hard to, like, you know, this is the biggest tournament for all of you and you're all sort of competing for the same title? Is that challenging?
I don't think so.
That's good.
Because I think everyone just realizes that, you know, everyone's on the same boat and everyone's there to win. So you're not, like, feeling particularly bad for anyone, because, you know, like, if it's not them, it's you, and
right.
It's better to them. I mean, the one time I felt really bad when I was playing Anya last year, and, like, she blundered against me. She blundered a queen, and yeah. It was a very difficult time for her because she had just lost her mother. And I mean, that time I felt really bad. Like, even because during the game I try not to feel bad, but
right.
I mean, I think you can't feel bad for your opponent. But, like, after, I felt really bad, and, like, I wanted to say something, but I feel like I can't.
Right. Yeah.
So that time was, you know, that's what, like, one time I felt, like, really, really bad.
Yeah, that situation is awkward just generally if someone has, like, something sad happen to them and you don't know what you should say or if you should say something. So if you throw in a, like, super competitive chess game on top of that, and I would be even more confused about, like, how I should address it.
Yeah, because, you know, when you're beating a friend and they're really upset, you want to comfort them. Like, you're the reason why they're upset.
Right, yeah.
Not a difficult spot to be in.
Yeah, and especially with the blunders, yeah, because those sting so much, like, even more so. Like, okay, if someone just grinds you down, you know, you tip your cap to them and move on. But if it's kind of, like, feels unjust, you know, it's got to be even harder.
Yeah, that was... Okay, like, I'm saying, like, I feel bad, but of course she felt 100 times worse than me.
Right, yeah, but every chess player knows what it feels like, that's for sure.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so Tatyov, I think we've covered most of the serious stuff that I have here on my list, but obviously I need to ask you about a topic very dear to you, penguins. what's the story with penguins? How did they become your obsession?
I don't know, actually. It wasn't specific things, but I feel like a lot of people encouraged it. So I would get all these gifts, like toys and like shirts and t-shirts and everything. So I think over time it just grew and grew. I just, you know, just really love them. They're amazing creatures.
So I imagine you've seen March of the Penguins?
No, actually I haven't.
Oh,
because
really?
I know the main penguin dies and I don't want to watch it.
Oh, okay. Yeah. That's funny. Yeah, I once told a friend of mine, actually the friend's husband may or may not hear this podcast, but a friend of mine, that I liked penguins. They were one of my favorite animals, and she kind of ran with it. They're like, I like them, but, like, you know, that's like if someone asks you what your favorite animal is, you have to name one, you know, so it's not like I was obsessed with them or anything. But anyway, I have a giant stuffed penguin in my house, too, that I wanted to show you before we were recording, but I didn't get a chance. But so I've also gotten penguin related gifts.
Yeah, I have like a box full of them, and I was thinking of donating them, but I kind of feel bad.
Well, it's a part of your brand, so.
Yeah, like my hair.
Right, yeah. Yeah, so is your hair, like, do you keep it the same color, or like how do you decide if you want to change it?
Actually, my hair is blue now, so I changed it for the season. But during the summer, I added some pink in it because it's more a summery color.
Okay. And do you know Kostya Kavutsky?
Yeah, of course.
And did you see that he dyed his hair blue?
Yeah, but his hair doesn't look blue. I don't know what happened there.
Do you have any advice for him as like a blue-haired individual?
Actually, maybe he washed it and it faded into that. So I'm kind of worried about because like when you get this kind of colorful hair, every time you wash it, it fades. And then sometimes the fading process is good. Sometimes it's just terrible. So I'm kind of scared of what's going to happen to my hair after a few washes.
Uh-oh. Speaking the voice of experience. So you must get some funny comments from kids about it.
No, actually, kids, I love my hair, and they always comment. They're like, oh, I like your purple hair. One of my students told me he likes my blue hair, so I said, oh, you don't like my purple hair. So, oh, I like your purple hair, but mine is curly, because my natural hair is curly. And I was like I never thought they'd pay so much attention to it. No, yeah. But my students love my hair.
That's funny. I'm guessing they asked to touch it and stuff like that?
Nah.
Okay.
The thing is, my hair is stained, so I don't
Okay. And Tatyev, what else, like, what are your interests outside of chess?
I'm into fitness and healthy living, and cooking, because I try to live a healthy lifestyle.
So many healthy chess players these days. Every time I ask someone, they're, like, exercising. No one says, like, well, one or two exceptions, but no one really says smoking and drinking.
Well, I mean, I think everyone does it. It's just no one says it.
Right. Yeah, it's true. I mean, and yeah, if you're going to do smoking and drinking, then you need to exercise even more. So.
So if you ask me what I'm passionate about and I say drinking alcohol, it's going to make me sound like a degenerate.
This is true. Although you did have a tweet about on that topic, I believe.
Oh, about buying wine.
Yeah. Buying wine at 11 a.m.
Yeah. You got to prepare for the week.
Yeah. No, it happens.
But I think it's like a trend now. Maybe it's just because I live in Southern California and everything is just exaggerated here. But I think a lot of people are into healthy living and fitness. Because now every store I go to, they have section of fitness clothes, like, you know, workout clothes. And like you go on Instagram, again, maybe it's just directed at me because that's what I follow. All these people who are building their brand just based on fitness and healthy lifestyle.
So you're trying to eat.
A good thing.
You're trying to eat healthy as well.
Yeah, I like on Sundays I'll meal prep, so I'll make my meals for the week, which is really time saving actually. So I'll make like lunch and salads, and like I'll cut my vegetables. So when I come home, I can just put something in the oven and cook quickly.
Nice. And so like what sort of diet do you try? I mean, not like diet in the sense of losing weight, but diet and like what sort of foods are you trying to eat to have a healthy lifestyle?
Well, I was vegetarian since high school.
Oh, wow. Okay.
Yeah, like senior year of high school, I think, or maybe junior. But I started eating fish several years ago, so I'm a pescatarian now.
Okay.
Which I kind of feel bad about, but I think it's healthier than... At least the way I was eating vegetarian was not healthy because you can't eat like pasta and carbs, rice. I try to eat mainly, I mean, what I like to eat and what I eat are a little different. But I try to eat a lot of vegetables. I just like to roast vegetables, like anything you put in the oven, I think just tastes good. And like try to eat more protein. Because I work out and like I lift weights, so I try to eat more like lean and clean diet.
Gotcha. You guys are such good role models for our younger listeners with your healthy eating. I'm good on the exercise, but I'm not such a good exemplar of healthy eating, I have to say.
No, neither am I actually. Like like when I eat out, or when that's my problem. When I eat out, like all my rules go out of the window. Or during the tournament, because I'm a stress eater, so
right.
I just eat anything. Especially like because a lot of times I have trouble sleeping, especially during tournaments. So when I don't sleep well, you know, it's like coffee and chocolate. And like anything, just to give my energy up.
Yeah.
But I think if I could apply this to when I'm traveling, then that'd be good. But I do. No, I mean, I think exercising is easy, so to say. You can do it, but being disciplined to to eat right. Because, you know, you eat more than you exercise. You have, like, several meals a day and you work out once a day. So it's harder to be eating right so many times.
Yeah, no. And, I mean, it's generally harder to eat healthy when you're traveling just because, you know, you don't have the groceries that you would have and the access to make stuff. But also competing in a chess tournament, you know, like, decision fatigue is a thing. Like, the more decisions you make, the easier it is to make bad ones. So it's like, you know, and obviously the nature of a chess competition is all you're doing is making decisions. So when you have another one about what to eat, I think it's hard to necessarily make the, you know, the choice that would be the healthiest. At least that's my excuse.
I'm such a bad decision maker. I'm gonna start using that excuse.
Exactly. Decision
that's
fatigue.
Great. Yeah.
Nice. All right. So what do you do? Okay, we're almost done here, but, like, what do you do in LA? Like, how do you like life in SoCal now that you're, you know, sufficiently adjusted from moving as a teenager?
Oh, I love LA. I think it's my favorite place to be. It, you know, it's always nice. The weather is nice. It's so pretty. I don't like the traffic, but fortunately I'm self-employed, so I don't have to be on the freeway during the rush hour. But I think Southern California is amazing.
Yeah, great weather. Seems like strong chess culture, too.
I think more so in NorCal now, unfortunately. But I think our scholastic chess is pretty strong. Because every time I go to a tournament, my opponents are getting younger and younger. Like, yeah. last tournament I played in, my opponent was tiny. And then I looked him up, and then it said he was born in, like, 2007 or something.
Oh my goodness.
And then, like, I had to take a moment to see, like, how old is 2007.
So that was your last round opponent?
It's my first round.
Oh, okay. Yeah, because I looked at the cross table. I didn't look at the games, but you played a couple, like, title players whose names I recognized, and then a couple sort of, like, you know, 22 to 2300s who I didn't. So I'm guessing those were the youngins.
Yeah, because when I see someone born in 2000, I still don't think they're real people, even though some of them are, like, graduating from high school already.
Right.
When I see, like, 2007, like, I have to take a moment and, like, actually do the math in my head just to see how old they are, because it's, you know, time is just going so fast and it's kind of crazy.
Nice. Okay. So, all right, last topic, Tatya. So we talked generically about, you know, your preparation and books and stuff like that, but, like, What advice do you give your students? Like, what's your philosophy of how people should improve at chess?
Well, that's a general question, but I think the main thing is tactics.
Yeah.
Being sharp and being able to calculate. Because, I don't know, until, like, 1800, 2000, I feel like it's the most important thing. Because I see, like, players, they'll play, like, they'll learn an opening, they blitz out their moves, and then later they'll, like, blunder, they'll miscalculate. So I think being able to calculate and, like, I think that's the talent, that having that talent is important. Like, being sharp, like, having that intuition for tactics. So I think it's very important to be able to build that up.
Yeah, that's generally my go-to advice as well, although I've been surprised how many guests here have said different things. You know, talking about chess, like Jan Gustafsson was talking about chess psychology, and you know, people say, like, he also said just study what you like. I'm trying to think of other examples, but for me it's like tactics is the answer, at least up in, like you say, up until around, say, 2000 or something like that. But people's advice runs the gamut. I think it's kind of not as interesting an answer, maybe.
But I think for younger players, like, I feel like some of them have some psychological issues, but for a lot of them, they just kind of let go of things more easily. Because, again, they don't have this baggage of, oh, like, this is going to happen, or that's going to happen, or I've had this experience. Like, some of them do, but, like, they'll get into a bad position, and then they won't be like, oh, no, I messed up my game, now I'm bad. They don't care about having to make, like, decisions that are, you know, it's like you have to put a piece on a bad square, and they're not like, oh no, like, what did I do? It's now I have to make this decision for them. They just play. And, like, when you say study what you like, I think that's a good thing to do when you're not motivated.
Right. Yeah, when you're old like me, it's good advice, I think. But if you're, like, yeah, really trying to climb the ladder, You kind of need to be practical about where the best return on your time is.
Yeah, and I feel like a lot of it, you have to change your attitude. And this is something, who did I hear this from? I think it's from, like I read an interview or something from Michael Brown, who's a player from Southern California.
Right.
I don't know if you know him.
Yeah, he's super, speaking of good tactics, yeah.
And he said, like, oh, he's always, like, fascinated by the position that's in front of him, you know, because every time you get a new position and, you know, like you may never have that position again, and he just tries to explore the position and learn something new. And I think that's a good attitude to have, because sometimes you find yourself in a position you don't like. So whenever I do that during the game, you know, I just try to tell myself, okay, you know, like I don't like this position, or I don't know this position, at least I can learn something from this.
Nice. Yeah, that's good advice for sure.
Again, this is something good in theory. In practice, doesn't always
right,
work.
Yeah.
But I think, you know, it's important. Like, if you keep doing it, it can become a habit. And instead of, like, I don't know if other players do it, but, you know, blaming yourself during the game or getting angry at yourself, kind of change your attitude so you can be more objective about the position in front of you.
Yeah, I think everyone has to reckon with that to some degree. Okay, so Tatyev, how, if people would like to thank you for this wonderful interview, or otherwise reach out to you, what's the best place to contact you?
I don't want people contacting me.
Well, you're on Twitter. I'll out you there. So
yeah, I was kidding. Yeah, I think on Twitter, because I try to keep my Facebook more private. I think on Twitter is a good way to contact me.
Okay. Yeah. So I'll link to that. But everyone, leave her alone.
I'm kidding.
All right. Yeah, I think that is everything. So good luck in the North American Open.
It's just American Open.
Oh, American Open. I can't keep the continental names straight because I always feel like they're kind of generic. So it's like I always know the tournament, but not the name. But anyway, we'll be rooting for you. And good luck beyond that as well.
Thank you.
Okay. Thanks for coming on, Tatu.
Thanks for having me.
Thanks to everyone who supports Perpetual Chess. I spend about 5 hours a week on each episode, and even though I love doing it, it can be hard to find the time. Donations from listeners make a huge difference and make Perpetual Chess a lot more sustainable. Special shout out to my Patreon Perpetual partners. They are Johnny McMenamin, Todd Bryant, Greg Shahadi, Jens Green, Timothy Ha, Tatyev Abramehan, Paul Swaney, Jennifer Shahadi, Pascal Charbonneau, Zhao Cheng, Kelly Palmer, Matthew Tedesco, Gary Andrews, Krishna Galapakrishnan, Ricky Grahava, Chris Flanagan, Coach J's Chess Academy, Rob Lazorchek, Jennifer Valens, Tim Seymour, and Chris Wainscott. Thanks a lot, everyone. I'll catch you guys next week with another episode.
Sports Social Podcast Network.
Step into the world of power, loyalty, and luck.
I'm gonna make him an offer he can't refuse.
With family, cannolis, and spins mean everything.
Now, you wanna get mixed up in the family business.
Introducing The Godfather at ChumbaCasino.com. Test your luck in the shadowy world of The Godfather slot.
Someday, I will call upon you to do a service for me.
Play The Godfather now at ChumbaCasino.com.
Welcome to the family.
No purchase necessary. VGW Group. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus. Terms and conditions apply.